reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, August 17, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. We'll start on the front page today. First article is headlined, "Contractor Who Bilked Homeowners Over Derecho Fixes Pleads Guilty. Prosecutors Pursuing a Sentence That Includes Restitution," by Emily Anderson. A Burlington contractor accused of taking thousands from four Linn County homeowners for derecho repairs but never finishing the work has agreed to plead guilty to first-degree theft charges, according to Linn County Attorney Nick Maybanks. Ryan Richard Standard, 50, originally was charged with first- and second-degree theft, but those charges were dismissed in April by a judge who said prosecutors missed a deadline to file trial information. Maybanks didn't agree but accepted the ruling and later charged Standard with the more serious charge of ongoing criminal conduct. The charge was amended earlier this month to a first-degree theft charge pursuant to a plea agreement. Maybanks said in an email that Standard entered an Alford plea, which means Standard acknowledges there is enough evidence to result in a conviction but maintains his innocence. Because Standard has not been sentenced yet, we will not comment on the particulars of any plea agreement. However, I can assure you that our office is pursuing an outcome that gives the victims in this case the best chance to receive restitution, Maybanks said. According to court documents, Standard stole over $32,000 total from the homeowners, Stephen Kafis, Jacqueline Burmeister, Thomas Herring, and Charles and Amber Cotton, all of Linn County. Standard did complete some of the work for a couple of the victims whose homes were damaged in the August 2020 derecho. Burmeister said Standard replaced her roof, but when she asked him to do her siding, he took her money and never came back. "I just wrote it off. I figured I was pretty stupid," Burmeister said. Herring also had his roof done by Standard, but not his siding, which he had also paid for. "That was our money that we had from the insurance to help replace the siding and so forth, so we had to dig into our own savings to get it fixed," Herring said. Herring said he has mixed feelings about the guilty plea. He's glad that Standard will be convicted, but he's worried that he and the other victims won't get their money back. "It's been a long time waiting for this. I'm to the point where I just want to get it over with and done, but I'm not expecting anything," Herring said. "I'm afraid he's going to settle and just get away with it without making payments or anything. That's my biggest concern, and I don't want him doing it to anybody else either." Herring isn't the only one who is concerned about money, despite Maybank's assurances that his office is pursuing restitution. Kafis, who had to postpone his retirement to pay for the house repairs that Standard didn't complete, said he's frustrated that he and the other victims weren't consulted about the plea agreement, which he fears won't lead to restitution. "I'm happy about the guilty plea because I knew from the beginning we had the evidence to convict him. We had it all, and that's what was frustrating about losing the first case," Kafis said. Kafis eventually was able to retire and is going to be moving to Arkansas, but he said he'll make sure to come back to give a statement at Standard sentencing, which is currently scheduled for October 25th. Also on today's front page, UI adding two floors to hospital pavilion. $95 million project is in addition to a new patient tower planned later, by Vanessa Miller, Iowa City. Well before University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics erects a new tower for patients, a long-term project officials revealed earlier this year as part of a 10-year master plan for the main campus. It is looking to spend $95 million adding two floors onto its existing inpatient tower. The UI this week issued a request for proposals from prospective construction managers for a vertical expansion of inpatient tower project on which crews would start work next summer, according to a university timeline. The total project budget, according to the UI request, is $95 million, with the construction portion accounting for $50.4 million. A summary of the project, spelled out in the request for qualifications from interested construction managers, indicated UIHC aims to add two floors to its existing eight-floor John Papa John Pavilion, increasing the tower to 10 stories by adding a total of 38,000 square feet. The budget also includes renovating floors 7 and 8. The new Level 9 will house an intensive care unit of 24 beds, and Level 10 will become a new mechanical penthouse serving the floors below. The renovated Level 7, encompassing about 33,000 square feet, and Level 8, involving about 19,000 square feet, will include new delivery and postpartum OBGYN care spaces, including inpatient beds, according to the request. The construction will be phased to accommodate current hospital operations, according to the documents which call for construction manager proposals by August 23rd. UI plans to notify a short list of finalists by August 31st, with selection coming after September, according to the request. UI Facilities Management records indicate it recently chose RDG Planning and Design from Des Moines for the architectural design services. The documents report UIHC's Governing Board of Regents authorized it to enter into the pre-design and schematic design phase of the project. Board spokesman Josh Lehman said the project is part of a 10-year master plan that the UI presented to the board in January when Regents gave it permission to proceed with planning. They would need to come before the board again for approval on project design and budget, Lehman said. UI's master plan documents, made public earlier this year, did not specifically outline any $95 million two-story vertical expansion of the John Papa John Pavilion, although it did mention the work vaguely in a timeline for three main modernization projects planned through 2031. Those new projects include an 842,000 gross square foot inpatient tower, a 320,000 gross square foot research and academic facility, and a 709,800 gross square foot outpatient tower. Enabling projects, paving the way for those bigger towers and research facilities, included utilities, demolitions, relocations, parking, and roads, according to a UI master plan slideshow. Among projects mentioned in the timeline for the UIHC campus modernization is JPP Pavilion expansion up, emergency department expansion, and internal renovations. The $95 million upward expansion will add to a growing list of projects UIHC is engaged in on and off its main campus. UI Healthcare last fall began work on a 469,000 square foot hospital campus in North Liberty, with officials recently increasing that project's budget 33% from $395 million to $525.6 million due to inflation. UIHC also is spending up to $15 million to replace windows in its relatively new 14-story Stead Family Children's Hospital while it pursues a lawsuit against the manufacturer. In addition to a list of more minor renovations across its main campus and hospital parking ramps, although some still topping $1 million, UIHC recently chose CMBA Architects PC of Des Moines and Myron Construction of Cedar Rapids to design and construct an emergency department expansion. For the tower expansion at the center of UIHC's recent request, officials are employing a construction manager at risk model involving a guaranteed maximum price for the work. The construction manager at risk shall assume responsibility for all costs of construction in excess of the guaranteed maximum price, according to the document. In making its case for a new tower offering additional inpatient beds, UIHC in January told Regents more than 44% of its aging hospital beds will be obsolete 10 years from now without renovation and modernization. Meanwhile, Iowa's healthcare needs will continue to expand. Iowa will need UIHC to grow by over 400 beds to satisfy complex healthcare needs of Iowans, according to the university's master plan presentation. If UIHC runs out of capacity, UIHC's financial stability will be threatened. The majority of that 400-bed need will come in adult acute care, with UIHC projecting it will need 279 more of those beds by 2031, plus 49 adult critical care beds, 19 pediatric beds, and 77 for behavioral health. The large increase in the number of patients that need to be seen at UIHC is driven by the aging of the population, creating more complex care needs, and retirement of community providers, according to the UIHC presentation. Hospital officials said they're committed to partnering with community hospitals and finding new efficiencies on campus, saving them from adding 196 beds to their 400-bed need. Across its campuses, UIHC's proposed growth over the next decade is expected to increase its inpatient bed days from 256,653 to 302,113, emergency visits from 52,987 to 69,338, surgical cases from 33,764 to 47,912, and clinic visits from 1.2 million to 1.8 million. The 10-year facilities plan for both the UI and UIHC intends to renew, right-size, and improve our campus for students, faculty, staff, and visitors, and for citizens of the state of Iowa who rely on highest quality health care, according to the UI presentation. Also on page one is this article, Child Hospitalized After Dog Attack in Springville. 8-year-old boy sustained severe bite wounds, by Gage Miskimen. An 8-year-old boy was hospitalized over the weekend after being attacked by 2 dogs in Springville. The child was attacked Friday afternoon by a Mastiff Pit Bull mix and another Pit Bull mix, according to Major Chad Colston of the Linn County Sheriff's Office. The child was treated at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids and transferred to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. The child was bitten in the head, face, arms, and legs. Some pretty gruesome injuries, Colston told the Gazette on Tuesday. Colston said it was apparent from the injuries that both dogs attacked the child, but the reason could not be determined as the child and a friend were playing video games in the room alone at the time. Nobody, adult, saw it, and nobody knows exactly what happened, Colston said. We've got an 8-year-old child who is our only witness, and with a number of bites on the child, both dogs joined in. Colston said that as of Monday, the child still was hospitalized with severe bite wounds, but was generally improving. Linn County doesn't have a breed-specific animal ordinance, but it does have a vicious animal ordinance for rare cases like these, Colston said. The dogs, due to the nature of the attack, have been deemed vicious by ourselves, Linn County Public Health, and Cedar Valley Humane Society. It's a collective thing, he said. Both dogs have been seized and placed in quarantine, one at a veterinary clinic and the other at the Cedar Valley Humane Society. Colston said the dogs' owners have been cooperative. At this point, we believe it is really reasonable that these dogs should be declared vicious, and we've had no pushback from the owners after what happened, Colston said. The big unknown is, what happened? Was the dog playing with a toy and the child tried to get the toy away from them? It's hard to say, and it was a surprise to the owners. We're thinking this is an unfortunate accident. Owners have a couple of days after being served a notice to appeal the vicious animal label. The notice was served Monday. If there is no appeal, the dogs will be euthanized. The attack in Linn County comes amid a push in neighboring Benton County and some of its cities to repeal breed ban ordinances. Benton County and the cities of Keystone and Vinton have bans on pit bulls. Last month, owners of pit bulls in Keystone received verbal warnings of the ban. In addition to the city ordinance, Benton County has its own ordinance that prohibits pit bulls and other dogs that have the characteristics of pit bulls. The warnings came after a 2-year-old girl was attacked June 18th by a stray or abandoned pit bull-style dog in Keystone. The girl was taken to the hospital and her father contacted authorities. Law enforcement took the dog to a veterinary clinic in Belle Plaine. An owner for the dog was never identified and the animal was euthanized. Benton County Sheriff Ron Tippett told the Gazette last month that the office did not give any official notices to residents, just a verbal heads up, reminding them of the ordinance. He said there was no plan to remove the dogs. The Keystone City Council didn't take any action this month after residents pleaded to let them keep their dogs. In Iowa, dozens of cities have breed-specific bans like Keystone's, including Belle Plaine, Cascade, Centerville, Columbus Junction, Council Bluffs, Monticello, Ottumwa, Vinton, Walcott, Waucon, and Winterset. But some cities have repealed breed-specific ordinances in recent years, including Sioux City, Muscatine, Maquoka, Maquoketa, Anamosa, and Ely. Moving on to local and regional news inside the paper, Uptown Marion Streetscape in final phase, part of 7th Avenue closing for 2 months, by Gage Miskimen. Marion. The long-awaited 7th Avenue Streetscape project in Uptown Marion is entering its final phase, which will close part of the busy street for the next 2 months. The project moved into the final phase Tuesday. Work is being done over 2 blocks between 8th and 10th Streets. The completion date for the entire project is set for this fall. It's exciting to be entering the final phase of this project, said Brooke Prouty, director of the Uptown Marion District and business liaison for the project. We appreciate all who have continued to show up and support our business community. There will be a lot to celebrate this fall. Parts of the major route through the heart of Marion have been closed over the last 2 construction seasons due to the major redevelopment effort. The $6.9 million project is being funded by local option sales tax dollars and bonding through the city's capital improvement program. Work includes the reconstruction of the street and sidewalks and the replacement of underground utilities, sanitary sewers, storm sewers, and water mains on 7th Avenue and side streets between 8th and 12th Streets and 6th and 8th Avenues. It also includes a new Uptown Plaza on 11th Street that will stretch from the city's Uptown Artway south across 7th Avenue. String lights also were installed in the plaza location. The new design of 7th Avenue as a festival street allows it to be closed for events. This year's farmers markets have taken full advantage of the new features. After completion of the streetscape project, focus will turn to Uptown Marion City Square Park and the Central Plaza project that will reimagine it. Marion recently received $3 million in federal American Rescue Plan funds allocated by the state to help fund the project. The award represents 40% of the total project investment of $9 million. The park's redesign includes an area that can be transformed into an ice skating rink in winter, an artistic peace tree to be the city's holiday centerpiece, flexible outdoor seating, water features, a play structure, event stage, and space for festival and market tents. The park's historic train depot also may see some upgrades, including turning it into a potential warming house during the winter, adding restrooms and installing mechanical rooms for the various water features. Judge, make owners in Summit's path public, by Danelle Eller of the Des Moines Register, Des Moines. The developer of a proposed $4.5 billion carbon dioxide capture pipeline in Iowa must release the names of landowners who could be impacted along its roughly 680-mile route, a district judge has ruled. A Summit Carbon Solutions, an Ames company that has proposed building a pipeline to transport liquefied carbon dioxide, failed to win a permanent injunction to keep secret the names of thousands of landowners it said could be in the pipeline's path. Under state law, Summit was required to hold public meetings for landowners potentially affected by the pipeline project, and the company compiled a list with more than 10,000 names along the route. After the Iowa Utilities Board asked Summit to submit the names, the company asked state regulators to keep the list confidential. Summit also filed a petition with the court to keep the names secret. The Sierra Club of Iowa asked regulators to release the names under the state's open records law, a move state consumer advocate Jennifer Easler also supported. In November, the Iowa Utilities Board decided it would keep secret most of the names, saying property owners' right to privacy outweighed the public's interest. The three-person board did, however, order Summit to release the names of businesses, cities, counties, and other government entities that own land along the proposed path. Board Chair Jerry Huser dissented, saying she would have released the property owners' addresses, but not their names. On Friday, Polk County District Court Judge David Nelmark said Summit had failed to show landowner information should be excluded from state public records law. He ordered a temporary injunction allowing Summit to keep landowner names confidential to be lifted in 14 days. Nelmark said the order's enforcement could be delayed if there is an appeal to the Iowa Supreme Court. Summit officials said Monday the company was reviewing its legal options. The Sierra Club has said Summit seeks to prevent the release of landowner information to shut down communication among Iowans who want to fight the pipeline. Summit vigorously fought to keep the landowner list confidential so the landowners could not form a unified opposition, Jess Mazur, the Sierra Club's conservation program coordinator, said in a statement. Summit said in its own statement that it sought to protect the privacy of our landowners and from harassment. We believe it is reasonable that landowners would get to choose whether or not their name, address, and contact information are made public, the company said. The company also said the information shouldn't be publicly released because to do so would help its competitors. Two other companies, Navigator CO2 Ventures and Archer Daniels Midland Company, partnering with Wolf Carbon Solutions, plan similar projects. Neither the Summit nor Navigator routes are proposed to run through Linn or Johnson counties. The proposed ADM Wolf pipeline would include collecting CO2 at ethanol plants in Cedar Rapids and Clinton. Summit Carbon Solutions, a company that agri-industry entrepreneur Bruce Rastetter started, proposes to capture carbon dioxide emissions from ethanol plants and other industrial agriculture operations in Iowa and four other states, then liquefy the gas under pressure and transport it to North Dakota, where it would be permanently sequestered underground. Hinson wants detailed justification for FBI search. Senator Grassley also urges public release of affidavit in Trump documents case, by Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Iowa Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson called on the U.S. Department of Justice to release more information about the FBI's search of former President Donald Trump's Florida estate. Hinson of Marion tweeted this week that the American people deserve full and immediate transparency and that it was past time for a detailed justification to prove this was not a political fishing expedition, even after the release of the search warrant and property receipt by order of a federal judge at the request of the Justice Department. The seized records include some that were marked classified as top secret and also sensitive compartmented information a special category meant to protect the nation's most important secrets, and those that, if revealed publicly, could cause exceptionally grave damage to U.S. interests, the Associated Press reported. The court records did not provide specific details about information the documents might contain. The search warrant, also unsealed Friday, said federal agents were investigating potential violations of three different federal laws, including one that governs gathering, transmitting, or losing defense information under the Espionage Act. The other statutes address the concealment, mutilation, or removal of records and the destruction, alteration, or falsification of records in federal investigations. Hinson's office said House and Senate Intelligence Committees should be given relevant documents as well as the FBI affidavit that provide a detailed justification for the search. After this unprecedented raid, the American people are rightly skeptical and deserve answers, Hinson said in a statement Tuesday. The DOJ must stop withholding critical information from Congress and the American people. Transparency brings accountability. Hinson added she strongly condemns any attacks or violence, including against those at the Justice Department and FBI or any member of law enforcement. Violence is never acceptable, Hinson stated about reports of increased threats against federal law enforcement following the search last week of Trump's Florida home. The Justice Department in court documents opposed efforts to make public the affidavit supporting the search warrant for Trump's residence, saying the investigation implicates highly classified material and the document contains sensitive information about witnesses. Publicly releasing the affidavit, according to the court filing, would cause significant and irreparable damage to this ongoing criminal investigation. The government's opposition came in response to court filings by several news organizations, including the Associated Press, seeking to unseal the underlying affidavit the Justice Department submitted when it asked for the warrant to search Trump's estate. In a statement Friday, Trump claimed that the documents seized by agents were all declassified, arguing that he would have turned over the documents to the Justice Department if asked. While incumbent presidents have the power to declassify information, that authority lapses as soon as they leave office, and it was not clear if the documents in question were ever declassified. Trump also kept possession of the documents despite multiple requests from agencies, including the National Archives, to turn over records in accordance with federal law. It remains unclear whether the Justice Department moved forward with the warrant simply as a means to retrieve the records or as part of a wider criminal investigation. Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley sent a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland on Monday, urging him to correct course and prioritize combating violent crime. The top Republican ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is tasked with conducting oversight of the Justice Department, Grassley has been vocal about his support for making the affidavit public. Marion Mann faces sex abuse charge. Alleged victim was incapacitated, by Emily Anderson. A Marion Mann was arrested Monday on charges of third-degree sexual abuse, felon in possession of a firearm, and possession of a controlled substance. John Wayne Brooks, 60, is accused of sexually assaulting a woman January 22nd while she was mentally and or physically incapacitated and or physically helpless, according to a criminal complaint. As part of the sexual assault investigation, Marion police conducted a search at Brooks' Marion residence where the alleged assault took place. While conducting the search, police found marijuana and a 9mm handgun, and a 9mm gun, the complaint states. Brooks is prohibited from owning a gun because of a 1999 felony conviction in Illinois for manufacturing and delivering a controlled substance. Brooks had his first court appearance Tuesday and is being held on a $16,000 cash or surety bond. A no-contact order has been filed on behalf of the woman. Grassley bashed for warning of IRS agents ready to shoot business owners. Iowa's senior U.S. Senator, Republican Chuck Grassley, was called out last week over remarks he made Thursday on Fox & Friends, speculating whether the IRS would use increased funding from the Inflation Reduction Act to send armed units of agents into small Iowa businesses. Are they going to have a strike force that goes in with AK-15s already loaded, ready to shoot some small business person in Iowa with these? Because I think they're going after middle class and small business people, because they think that anybody that has pass-through income is a crook, and they aren't paying their fair share, and we're going to go after them, he said. Democrats blasted Grassley's remarks as inaccurate, irresponsible, and an incendiary conspiracy theory that incites violence against federal authorities, noting just hours before his remarks, a gunman opened fire on FBI agents in Cincinnati. Fact-checking website PolitiFact called claims that new funding to beef up IRS enforcement included in the recently passed Inflation Reduction Act would militarize the IRS was outlandish. The IRS buys guns and ammunition for special agents in its Criminal Investigation Division, who investigate crimes ranging from major drug and money laundering operations to illegal gaming operations and corporate fraud. The typical IRS auditors that Americans would encounter in an audit are unarmed, and the vast majority of those audits are done by mail, PolitiFact reported. The fact-checking website also reported the division has been armed for more than a century, and its spending on ammunition this year is on par with previous years and less than what was spent a decade ago. Grassley's office said the Inflation Reduction Act, signed into law Tuesday by President Joe Biden, includes an additional $80 billion to beef up IRS enforcement, including hiring 87,000 additional IRS employees. In that context, he was asked about an IRS job posting that listed as its major duties the ability to carry a firearm and be willing to use deadly force, according to Grassley's office. Senator Grassley answered with a rhetorical question, with his point being, why do we need more armed IRS agents? The IRS is being flooded with taxpayer dollars to boost audits targeting American small businesses at their expense. If anything, Senator Grassley believes Congress should be focused on providing more IRS services so people can get the return faster instead of going after small businesses. And the only byline on this article says, The Gazette. Hy-Vee names Gosh CEO of Retail Operations. Randy Ettaker will be Board Chairman, Executive Director, by The Gazette. In the most recent shift in corporate positions, Hy-Vee Tuesday announced Jeremy Gosh as CEO and President of the West Des Moines-based chain's retail operations, as well as Vice Chairman of its Board of Directors. Gosh had been President and Chief Operating Officer of Hy-Vee's retail operations. Gosh will head the company along with Aaron Weiss, who is named as CEO and President of Hy-Vee's subsidiaries and supply chain. Weiss also will be a board vice chairman. Both changes will be effective October 1st. As I look ahead to the future, we've reached a point where one person can no longer hold the title of chairman, CEO, and president for the entire company, current chairman and CEO Randy Ettaker said in a news release. We've become more than just a grocer. With our focus on health and wellness, pharmacy, restaurants, grocery, distribution, and digital assets, it's time we involved our leadership structure to best position the business for the future, which is why Jeremy will also serve as a CEO for the company. Gosh and Weiss will continue to report to Ettaker, who will stay with Hy-Vee as board chairman and executive director, according to the release. The pair will move up in the chain's leadership during evolving times for retail. Hy-Vee in April asked up to 500 additional employees to move from corporate-level jobs to retail positions at its stores. In March, it eliminated 121 corporate-level positions, with 102 of those employees offered retail positions at its stores. In a full-page advertisement in the April 27th Gazette, the company cited economic challenges and uncertain times ahead for the retail food sector. Gosh started with the chain as a part-time clerk at the Lantern Park Plaza store in Coralville in 1995. Over the next 12 years, he worked his way up to store director at several locations. In 2012, he was promoted to assistant vice president for operations, Northeast Region. Over the next 6 years, he held various executive roles, and in 2018, Gosh was promoted to executive vice president, co-chief operating officer, and chief marketing officer. Late that year, he transitioned into chief operating officer. In April 2021, Gosh became president of retail operations and co-chief operating officer. He took over in his current position in December 2021. Cedar Rapids Market After Dark returns for seventh year by Elijah Decius. Market After Dark returns for its seventh annual end-of-summer celebration in downtown Cedar Rapids on August 27th. This year's free outdoor event features more than 100 vendors, live entertainment from multiple artists, special lighted attractions, games, and more, with open container drinking for those 21 and older. Market After Dark is one of our community's most anticipated events of the summer, said Maddox Stovey, events coordinator for the Cedar Rapids Metro Economic Alliance. We are excited to bring back entertainment and a few other surprises to make this night a festive and fun atmosphere that everyone can enjoy. From 6:30 to 11 p.m., patrons 21 years of age and older can enjoy beer and wine in specially marked cups from participating downtown establishments within the designated market area. All drinks will be served in disposable cups until 10:30 p.m. Water and canned soda will be available for $3, and a non-alcoholic tent in Green Square will feature Millstream soda and floats for $4 and $6, respectively. This year, vendors will be located along 2nd Avenue Southeast, 3rd Avenue Southeast, and 4th Avenue Southeast, between 2nd Street Southeast and 5th Street Southeast. Entertainment returns on three stages throughout the venue. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, August 17, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Ben Dixon, Jr. of Cedar Rapids. Ben Dixon, Jr., 68, passed away August 12, 2022. Visitation will be held from 11 a.m. until time of funeral service, 1 p.m., Saturday, August 20th, at Word of Faith Pentecostal Church, 2325 16th Avenue Southwest, Cedar Rapids. Interment with military honors will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Ben is survived by his wife Deborah, children Deisha Morgan, Adam Cook, Amanda Dixon, Cora Dixon, and James Hall II. 17 grandchildren, 9 great-grandchildren, mother Cora Cooks, brother Robert Jenkins, and a host of nieces, nephews, and cousins. He was preceded in death by his son Anthony T.J. Dixon and father Alvin Cooks. Ben retired from Cargill after 41 years and 9 months of dedicated service. Online condolences may be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com. Chrissy Rosendahl of Cedar Rapids. Chrissy was a loving wife, mother, daughter, and friend. She is the daughter of Ari and Wilma Spolstra of Pella, Iowa. She was born July 13, 1960. She put up a good fight against cancer for 13 years. She never let it rule her life. Chrissy is the wife to Dennis Rosendahl and the mother of Emily, Nick, McKeag, and Jacob Rosendahl. Sister to Marlis Hoeksbergen and Royce Sharon Spolstra. Sister-in-law to Dale, Jana Rosendahl, Marla, Eugene Siartema, Rodney, Dana Rosendahl, and Ross, Kara Rosendahl. She enjoyed reading, serving her community, visiting with family and friends, and serving the church. She was an elder at Cedar Hills Community Church. Visitation will be at Cedar Hills Community Church in Cedar Rapids from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, August 17, 2022. The memorial service will be held at Cedar Hills Community Church at 11 a.m. Thursday, August 18, 2022. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made in Chrissy's name to the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center at UIHC. Online condolences and memories may be shared with the family at iowacremation.com. Muriel M. Wagner, 77, of Iowa City, died Monday, August 15, 2022, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Services celebrating Muriel's life will begin at 3 p.m. Saturday, August 20, 2022, at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service, where a time of visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the services. Burial will be at St. Joseph's Cemetery in Iowa City. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established in her memory. For a complete obituary to share a thought, memory, or condolence, please visit Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service website at gayandchia.com. David Brian Rutherford went to be with the Lord on July 30, 2022, at his home in Tyler, Texas. David was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, September 19, 1963, to Kenneth Rutherford and Catherine Morris Rutherford. He graduated from Linmar High School, received a degree in psychology from the University of Iowa. He served 4 years in the U.S. Navy as a pharmacy technician. Later in life, David was a Smith County deputy constable and police officer in the city of Troop. He was very proud of the time he served in law enforcement. David was preceded in death by his mother, Catherine Morris Rutherford, and aunt, Ann Morris. He is survived by his father, Kenneth Rutherford, a sister, Catherine Rutherford, a brother, Kenneth Rutherford Jr., Robin, 3 nephews, John Sikora, Allie, Jeff Sikora, Ashley, and Tyler Rutherford, a niece, Brenna Rutherford, 9 grandnieces and 1 grandnephew, and 2 great-grandnephews. In lieu of flowers, a donation may be made to the police department of your choice to honor David's life. Donald R. Vinsky, 83, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Sunday, August 14, 2022, at the Aldorf Hospice House, surrounded by his wife and daughters. A visitation will be held at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids from 4 to 7 p.m. on Friday, August 19, 2022, with a vigil starting at 4 p.m. A funeral mass will be held at Immaculate Conception Church at 10 a.m. on Saturday, August 20, 2022, with burial at St. John's Cemetery. Luncheon will follow at Immaculate Conception SCOTUS Hall. Don was born in Frytown, Iowa on November 19, 1938, the son of Albert and Irene Grieselvensky. In 1945, his family moved to Iowa City. Don graduated from City High in 1957 and studied engineering at the University of Iowa. Don worked as an engineering designer and was awarded multiple patents for his circuit breaker designs. He enjoyed spending time outside, running, skiing, skating, boating, camping, and swimming. But the activity that he loved most was cycling. Don rode his bicycle to Square D every day, where he worked from 1969 until he retired in 2004. He competed in tour racing and time trial racing in the senior games at the state and national level. He was an enthusiastic racer and a medal winner. He custom-built bikes for over 30 years. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the Frank P. and Marie M. Woods Family Fund in care of the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation. Please share a memory of Don at MurdochFuneralHome.com under obituaries. Heidi K. Teckow, 53, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away on Sunday, August 14, 2022. There will be no services. Arrangements are with Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Cedar Rapids. Survivors include her husband of 34 years, Larry, children Heather, Matt, Wiley, Jacob, Alyssa Teckow, and Hannah Teckow, grandson Jameson, and mother-in-law Rose Teckow. Heidi was born on May 24, 1969, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Howard and Sarah Bernardini Yanish. After serving in the U.S. Coast Guard, Heidi loved being a mom and grandma and spending time with the crew. When she wasn't babysitting her grandson and practicing her Spanish and German, Heidi enjoyed feeding people, claiming food is love. She was preceded in death by her parents and granddaughter, Elizabeth Rose Wiley. Please share your support and memories with Heidi's family on her tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com under obituaries. Dorothy Dottie Berger of Hiawatha died Saturday, August 6, 2022 at Hiawatha Care Center. A memorial service will be held on Saturday, August 20, 2022 at noon at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories with a visitation 1 hour prior. Interment will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Mount Moriah. Dorothy was born January 1, 1935 to John and Edith Oakland. She graduated from Iowa State University in 1959 with a B.S. in Food and Nutrition Dietetics. She completed her dietetic internship at Alameda County Hospitals in Oakland, California in 1960. Dorothy served as a registered dietitian at Stanford University Hospital in Palo Alto, California, Iowa Methodist Hospital in Des Moines, Iowa, University of Iowa Hospital in Iowa City, Iowa, and Abbey Center, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. She also served as a dietary consultant for several nursing homes in Scott and Linn counties. Dottie married Kenneth Berger in 1970. They owned and managed several rental properties together. He preceded her in death in 2015. She was a friend of Bill W. since 1971 and enjoyed traveling, reading, and helping others. She loved her family and friends and never met a stranger. If you didn't know Dottie when you entered a room, you were fast friends before you left the room. Her sense of humor and desire to help endeared her to many. Memorial donations may be given to the Iowa Alzheimer's Association, the Heart of Iowa program of the Area Substance Abuse Council of Cedar Rapids, the Family Caregivers Center of the Mercy Medical Center Foundation of Cedar Rapids, or the Unity Center of Cedar Rapids. Online condolences may be left at cedarmemorial.com. Marlene Marie Berndt of Denison, the daughter of Christ and Olga Jensen Jensen, was born on September 22, 1926, in Laurel, Nebraska. She died at Hallmar Nursing Facility in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, on Friday, August 12, 2022, at 3:05 a.m. at the age of 95 years, 10 months, and 21 days. Marlene was born at home in Laurel, Nebraska. She was baptized and later confirmed in her faith at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Laurel. She grew up in the Laurel area and attended public school there. In her later teens, she moved to Western Iowa and was employed in several positions until she met her future husband. She was united in marriage to Frank Berndt on September 23, 1945, at his parents' family farm. They farmed around Monona and Crawford County for 36 years until they moved to Denison in 1981. Their marriage was blessed with two children, Mike and Sandy. Marlene started working at the Crawford County Memorial Hospital shortly after they moved to Denison as a cook in the dietary department. She was very proud of her accomplishments and was known for her cooking skills. After retirement, Marlene and Frank enjoyed traveling throughout the West and North Central United States until his health declined. She was a devoted caregiver to Frank and was a frequent visitor and volunteer at the Denison Care Center during his stay. Due to health issues, Marlene moved to Cedar Rapids, Iowa in 2017 to be closer to her daughter. She became a much-loved member of the Cedar Rapids community and continued to share her love of baking with her care team. Marlene continued to be a caregiver for other residents, and she shared that one of her greatest regrets was not becoming a nurse. Funeral service were held 1 p.m. Tuesday, August 16, 2022 at Zion Lutheran Church in Denison, Iowa. The Huebner Funeral Home was in charge of arrangements. Evelyn Teresa Terry Culberson, 82, of Marion, Iowa, passed away on Saturday, August 13, 2022 at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital. Funeral service will begin at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, August 20, 2022 at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Visitation will be from 9:30 a.m. to service time at the funeral home. Burial will follow at the Masonic Cemetery in Tipton, Iowa. Terry was born on April 10, 1940, in Washington, Iowa, the daughter of Edward and Mina Shea Teslick. In 1958, she was a part of the first graduating class of Cedar Rapids Jefferson High School. On July 3, 1959, Terry was united in marriage to Dean Culberson in Cedar Rapids. Dean died March 10, 2022. Terry took charge as the project manager for her husband and family. She worked for Square D from 1958 until retirement in 1995. Terry enjoyed collecting cookie jars and gardening. She loved spending her time with her family, grandchildren, and dogs. Terry will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved her. In lieu of flowers, memorials in Terry's memory may be directed to the Cedar Valley Humane Society at 7411 Mount Vernon Road, Southeast Cedar Rapids, Iowa, 52403, or Dogs Forever at 809 Rockford Road, Southwest, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, 52404. Please share a memory of Terry at murdockfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Wendy Suzette Robinault, 61, of Cedar Rapids, found rest with the Lord on Sunday, August 14, 2022. She will be lovingly remembered by her husband of 43 years, John, daughter Lindy, Brian Kobliska, and granddaughters Caitlin and Celeste, who were the lights of her life. Wendy was preceded in death by her son Luke, her parents Clark and Judy Hagen, and her sister Michelle Cross. A visitation will be held at Cedar Memorial, 4200 First Avenue Northeast, Cedar Rapids, on Thursday, August 18th from 4 to 7 p.m. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, August 19th at Northbrook Baptist Church, 1700 Boyson Road Northeast, Cedar Rapids. In lieu of flowers, please remember Wendy with donations to the hospice unit at St. Luke's in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Helen Virginia Supple, 95, of Hopkinton, passed away in her home on Sunday, August 14, 2022. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, August 19, 2022, at St. Luke Catholic Church in Hopkinton. Funeral Mass will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 20, 2022, at St. Luke Catholic Church, with Father John Kramer and Deacon Ed Goldsmith presiding. Virginia was united in marriage to Justin T. Supple on February 16, 1949. To this union, four children were born: Pat, Marna Supple, Kathy Zimmerman, Connie, Ed Goldsmith, and Mike, Julie Supple, along with 15 grandchildren, 17 great-grandchildren, and one great-great-grandchild. Remembrances can be mailed to 1748 310th Street, Ryan, Iowa, 52330. A full obituary will be available at broschchapel.com. Stephen G. Perrin, 78, of Altoona, passed away peacefully on August 12, 2022. A visitation will be held at Sunset Memorial Chapel in Des Moines, Iowa, on Thursday, August 18, from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. A service will be held at Sunset Memorial Chapel on Friday, August 19, at 11 a.m. Burial will be held afterwards at Glendale Cemetery in Des Moines, Iowa. Stephen's family invites attendees to join them for a luncheon after the burial at Sunset Memorial Chapel. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions can be made to Stephen's family. To read Stephen's full obituary, please visit sunsetmemorialchapel.com. John J. Meehan, 79, of Marion, passed away Saturday, August 13, 2022 at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Visitation will be held from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, August 23, 2022, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion, where a mass of Christian burial will commence at 10:30. Reverend David O'Connor will preside. Burial will be at St. Francis Xavier Cemetery in Dyersville. John was born April 5, 1943, in Detroit, Michigan, the son of Michael and Marguerite Doyle Meehan. He graduated from Denison High School, earned his bachelor's degree from Loras College, and earned a master's degree in business administration from St. Ambrose University. He met the love of his life, Jean Drexler, while in college. They married on December 27, 1967, at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville. John worked at Rockwell Collins and Banks of Iowa Computer Services. John's favorite hobby was flying and teaching flying lessons. John was an avid reader and loved history, spending a lot of time learning about his ancestors. He enjoyed technology and computers. He adored spoiling his grandchildren and regularly spent time with them. Memorials are preferred. Online condolences may be left for the family at kramerfuneral.com. Leon F. Fred Lang, 84, of Onslow, Iowa, passed away Wednesday, June 29, 2022, in Athol, Idaho. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, August 20th, at Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello, where a memorial service will commence at 11 a.m. Burial of Leon and his wife Phyllis will follow at Scotch Grove Cemetery, Scotch Grove, Iowa. Fred was born on April 22, 1938, in Canton, Iowa, the son of Leo and Donna Carpenter Lang. He married Phyllis on December 6, 1959, in Maquoketa, Iowa. In May of 1962, Leon and Phyllis moved to a farm in rural Onslow, where they would call home for many years. When he wasn't busy farming, he enjoyed being outdoors. He loved fishing, hunting, mushroom hunting, and picking berries. Leon loved a good game of cards with the family. Leon and Phyllis will be remembered for the golden American saddlebred horses. Most of all, he loved his children and grandchildren. Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville is assisting the family, and information is available at kramerfuneral.com. Online condolences and memorials may be sent to Kramer Funeral Home, 750 12th Avenue Southwest, Dyersville, Iowa, 52040. Mary Orth, 83, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully on Monday, August 15, 2022, at the Denison Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy, following a short illness. Services, 10 a.m. on Monday at St. Jude Catholic Church by the Reverend Nick March. Burial, Mount Calvary Cemetery. A vigil service will be held on Sunday at 4 p.m. at TN Funeral Home. Those not attending the vigil service may visit with the family on Sunday from 4:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. and on Monday at the church after 9 a.m. Mary was born January 23, 1939 in Burlington, Iowa, the daughter of Helen Fleming and Leonard Orth. She grew up in various cities, with Helena, Montana being her favorite place filled with childhood memories. She graduated high school in 1957 in Indiana. Mary attended community college and quickly found her career at the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. During her 44 years at the Gazette, Mary was the advertising manager for international and classified ads. Mary was a charter member of St. Jude Catholic Church, and she taught RCIA, Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults, participated in several committees, volunteered countless hours, and met numerous friends along the way. She also was a volunteer for many years at Mercy Hospital, delivering Holy Communion to patients and helping guide visitors and patients at the Halperine Cancer Center. Mary was a worldwide traveler, enjoyed playing golf, and hosting weekly social events. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be directed to the Denison Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy or St. Jude Catholic Church. Cards for the family may be sent to Heidi Romidko, P.O. Box 56, Swisher, Iowa, 52338. Online condolences can be left at tnfuneralhome.com. Elaine Hopp Langenberg of Iowa City passed away Thursday, August 11, 2022, following a short illness. Services for Elaine will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, August 19th at Memory Garden Cemetery in Iowa City for family and friends to attend. Elaine was born to Everett and Hester Wyjack Hopp on March 11, 1924, growing up in the farming community of Morse, Iowa. After graduation from Iowa City High School and the Iowa City Business College, she was employed at the University of Iowa College of Education as an administrative assistant until her retirement in 1989. She loved her job and enjoyed helping people, and after retirement went on to do various volunteering projects. Elaine was united in marriage to Joseph John Langenberg at St. Mary's Catholic Church on June 27, 1946. They had an active life together, sharing a love of music, playing cards, camping, pro baseball games, dining out, concerts, visiting children in Kansas City and Minneapolis, and enjoying their grandchildren. After Joe's death in 1988, Elaine continued to live a full and happy life, spending much of her time with her children and grandchildren, and the many lifelong friends she made along the way. Some of her travels include Hawaii, Rome, Florida, Chicago, and Branson, Missouri, to name just a few. She was a loyal Iowa Hawkeyes fan, loved to play cards with her friends, sew for gift giving, cook, and bake wonderful pies. She never missed a day working a crossword puzzle. Suffice it to say, she lived a wonderful and long life, and for that her family will be forever grateful. In lieu of flowers, the family would request consideration of monetary donations to the disabled American veterans, which was an important charity to her. Online condolences and memorial donations may be made at lensingfuneral.com. Helen Roth, 102, of Marion, passed away peacefully at Silver Oak Nursing Center, Marion, Iowa, on Thursday, August 11, 2022. A visitation will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories on Friday, August 19, 2022, from 9 to 11 a.m., followed by the memorial service. Helen was born March 21, 1920, in Marion, Iowa, a daughter of Charles and Ethel Reynolds Dawes, and on November 20, 1937, she married Kenneth Roth in Omaha. Helen lived her entire life in Marion and spent her first 90 years residing in the house in which she was born. Helen was a devoted wife of 68 years, the greatest mother a child could ask for, and a great friend to many, especially her neighbors. Most of all, she loved and adored her grandchildren. Her kind and sweet soul, along with her timid giggle, will be dearly missed by all. Memorial contributions may be made in Helen's name to a charity of one's choice. That concludes today's obituaries. And we'll finish today with the editorial page. There are two letters to the editor. The first is titled, Who is Indoctrinating Who? It is from Daryl Syverson of Strawberry Point. Last week, Cal Thomas called for the burial of the public school system. His main argument was the system is indoctrinating students with left-wing ideas and harmful social ideology. By definition, indoctrination is teaching a group to accept a set of beliefs uncritically. In other words, teachers are brainwashing students. According to Thomas, these students would be better served by private schools and homeschooling. If Thomas is correct, why is Iowa becoming a more conservative state? Why does Iowa have a Republican governor? Why do Republicans dominate the Iowa General Assembly and the Iowa Supreme Court? Why do student polls prior to elections almost always vote for the Republican candidate? Who is indoctrinating who? And again, that letter is from Daryl Syverson of Strawberry Point. Next is titled, Support Vet-Owned Businesses. Recently, I have been reflecting on my journey from my time in service to full-time business owner traveling the state in my coffee food bus. I started the Traveling Bean Company with a mission to inspire and empower. During these uncertain economic times, veterans need our support more than ever. I'm encouraged that the unemployment rate for veterans is holding steady at 2.7%. However, that could change overnight. That's why it's critical to support veteran-owned businesses and those that make a point to hire veterans. It's easy for Iowans to support small businesses from the comfort of their homes, including veteran-owned businesses through Facebook and Instagram shops. I encourage Iowans to support our veterans who have given so much to us and don't ask for much in return. And that letter is from Marie Miller of Johnston. Finally, there's a guest column today from Stephen Bradley, who is a Republican state representative from Maquoketa, and he is also a doctor. The title is Fully Fund Medicaid in Iowa. A majority of states across the country, including here in Iowa, currently use managed care for at least some portion of their Medicaid program. This approach attempts to identify and address an individual's current and even potential health care issues before they become chronic, severe, and costly. For example, regular physicals and other health care screenings can help with early detection of diabetes, heart issues, cancer, and more. In Iowa, we have nearly 800,000 people who are enrolled in the Medicaid system. With those types of numbers, it stands to reason that most Iowans know someone who is a Medicaid member, whether that is a friend, extended family member, or neighbor. Within this population, there are approximately 417,000 children who receive health care through Medicaid, which makes it all the more important that the program is fully funded in delivering the full range of services the state has promised. More than 6 years ago, Iowa, under the leadership of then-Governor Terry Branstad and current Governor Kim Reynolds, made the decision to shift Medicaid to managed care. I believe this was the right decision. For Medicaid members, it means better health care outcomes. For policymakers and taxpayers, it provided a mechanism to bring more stability to our state budget, and in doing so, helped avoid the skyrocketing health care cost increases. That's not to say, however, there haven't been challenges. For healthcare providers across the state, there have been issues transitioning from an entirely state-run program to a privately managed system. This has caused headaches when it comes to billing and payments, which have the potential to create financial strains for providers of all sizes. A couple of managed care organizations who had been selected to administer the program chose to leave the state, citing a disparity between the services they were required to cover and the funding allocated to provide them. I believe there is room for improvement in Iowa's Medicaid reimbursement rates, particularly for dentists such as myself. Iowa's Medicaid program only reimburses 20 cents on the dollar for dental services. This has caused many dentists throughout the state to stop accepting Medicaid members as patients. Even more have been forced to restrict the number of Medicaid patients they take on. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, August 17th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.